Okay, so maybe just to start today, so what we did in the last lecture is to study the geometry of conformal symmetry. Just what are the collection of transformations that are conformal transformations in flat space? You could ask a similar question about other space times, like De Sitter space or anti-De Sitter space, or any black hole, whatever geometry you like. You can ask what are the conformal isometries, conformal Killing vectors of that space. But in this course, we will mostly focus on flat space, flat Minkowski space. And what we found is that the infinitesimal transformations, some measures, are parameterized by a conformal Killing vector, took this simple form. So it was a translation, Lorentz rotation, a dilatation, and a special conformal transformation. Okay. And this gave rise to the conformal algebra, which was in these space-time dimensions, SO2, D. Okay. So that's one. Then I commented that there is an important conformal transformation that is not of the infinitesimal form. There's a Z2 conformal transformation. Which was inversion that mapped X mu to X mu over X square. That had the property that if you take translations, the group generated by translations with acted with inversions, this generates the full conformal group. All four components of the conformal group, yes.
Sorry, I just don't know why, what is like the argument to add two extra dimensions?
I'm not adding them. It's just that you have a set of symmetries and they have to form a Lie algebra. It just happens that Lie algebra is identified with the orthogonal Lie algebra of a space-time in two dimension higher. Actually, these extra dimensions are not can be given some more teeth. Actually, so these transformations here, they look nonlinear, right? In particular, these things are nonlinear transformations. So one way actually in which you can make the action of the conformal group linear is by embedding things in a higher dimensional space. Just like, I think I'd mentioned that if you have a sphere, like S2, right? S2 has an SO3 symmetry, right? But the symmetries of the two sphere, when you look at the coordinates of the two sphere, they're not linear transformations, right? They're complicated nonlinear transformations. But you can make them explicit by embedding the two sphere on a three-dimensional space, right? So you have, right? And now the SO3 symmetry is totally obvious because it's just a symmetry that rotates R, XI, like this way, where R obeys R trans plus R equals 1, which is the definition of SO3. So all these crazy nonlinear transformations can be obtained as a linear transformation in a space with higher dimension. But we're always in D dimensions. I mean, we're not living in D plus two dimensions. It's just that the Lie algebra of symmetries can be thought of as the Lie algebra of symmetries of an orthogonal group that acts on a higher dimensional space. But it's also, there is a connection with higher dimensions through the idea of CFT correspondence, for example. And more concretely, that you can derive, just like you can derive the nonlinear transformations that act on the coordinates, on the two coordinates of the two sphere from this, you can derive the nonlinear transformations that I wrote here from the linear transformations that act on the D plus two dimensional higher dimensional space. But we're not changing dimensions. We're always in D dimensions, yes.
Is it always true that given an action which is not necessarily linear, you can always embed your
No, of course not. No. These are very special because these are maximally symmetric symmetries in some sense. Like you can do this for the maximally symmetric spaces like De Sitter, anti-De Sitter, and flat space, but not if I give you, in general, no. I mean, I don't think in general you can do that. Actually, in general, the most spaces don't have any symmetries. So, the yeah. More questions. And actually, I think in the notes I have some discussion of how to use this embedding of into a higher dimensional space to derive this from the linear transformation in the higher dimensional space. This, I think this is in some version of the note it was there, but I cannot promise it's there. But maybe the reason I'm not doing it in the lecture is that I think that would take us too far afield. That point of view is very useful for some perspectives of deriving the constraints of conformal symmetry when you look at tensors, Lorentz tensors, which are, you know, have lots of indices and looks complicated. And doing it from this nonlinear point of view may look unwieldy, while from that point of view, it's more transparent. But yeah. So, okay, so the point is that there was this inversion transformation and combined with translation, it generated everything. So one point I didn't really emphasize is what is that these are the infinitesimal transformations, right? Now you can ask, what if I make a large translation or a large rotation or a large blah, blah, blah. So I think you know what happens if you do a large translation. Well, nothing much happens, and also a large dilatation. Now you may ask, what is the finite form? If I do a finite and infinitesimal transformation, a finite special conformal transformation. So this is a transformation that is obtained by taking a limiting procedure where you make many small special conformal transformations, and then it looks like this. So I'm just writing the answer, but you can make many checks that this is correct. And this is definitely very nonlinear, as you can see. It's a finite transformation, so it's something like 1 plus 2 b dot x plus b square x square. Now, what is some sanity check that this is correct? Well, now let's make the Let's make this transformation infinitesimal. That means that I make b very small, right? So I just keep the terms that are linear in b in the finite transformation. So now I make it infinitesimal by just expanding this in a Taylor series. So from upstairs, I just have this, right? And now I have to expand 1 over something. And you remember from, I think I screwed up the sign. I think I screwed up some signs here. It should be a minus sign.
You expand that, you can find it.
Yes. Okay. I forgot my Taylor series. Yes. So now if you expand this, the point is that 1 plus epsilon is 1 minus epsilon, right? To leading order. So from here you get minus 2b dot x, x mu, which is precisely this, okay? Another way you can say is that, as I claimed, and you can show at the level of infinitesimal vectors, is that the special conformal transformation can be obtained by conjugating a translation twice. And it's an exercise, well, let's do it. No, okay, let me not do it. So you can take the finite form of a translation, which is mapping x mu plus x mu plus a mu, and follow this chain, and you will exactly derive this transformation. Okay. Good. One thing that's it's important to remark about special conformal transformations, which are the ones that are less obvious, is that just like translations can be always used to bring any point to the origin, right? You can always translate a point to the origin. With a special conformal transformation, you can pick any point in space-time and find a transformation that will map that point to infinity. Okay, look at this denominator. Choose any x that you like. There's always a b such that the denominator is 0. Okay. So if you wish, this is what I said already before, that you can think of translations, the usual translations, as something that shifts things near the origin, but fix infinity, while a special conformal transformation, it does the opposite. It fixes the origin. In particular, it fixes the origin. You can see that. It's a fixed point of this transformation. And it moves things around infinity. Okay. So this was just about, if you wish, geometry and kinematics. Now what we want to do is study how conformal symmetry constrains a quantum field theory. So we started with a in usual quantum field theory we have Poincaré, which is SO1d minus one, and in a conformal field theory, that's just a standard quantum field theory. In a conformal field theory, this is enhanced to SO2d. Okay. So we want to understand what other constraints beyond Poincaré does a theory that have conformal symmetry obey. Okay. And we will see that this is extremely powerful, that essentially allows us to fix completely the position dependence of correlation functions between 2 points and 3 points. And then for higher points, it's completely fixed by those ones in lower points. So that's kind of the goal of today. But before that, we have to understand, this was just geometry. We need to understand how to realize, how to represent conformal symmetry on operators, also in the Hilbert space. So in a quantum field theory, we have a collection of operators. And if the theory has a symmetry, we have to find the representation of that symmetry on the operator. So that's the thing that we're going to do today. So essentially what I'm going to do is I'm going to explain how operators in a CFT are acted on by conformal transformation. Just like you're familiar that in a relativistic quantum field theory, operators are labeled by the representation of the Poincaré group, and you need to know how your operators transform under the quantum numbers of the Poincaré group, which are essentially the spin. Okay. Now we have new quantum numbers that we will have to. I already mentioned we have also the scaling dimension, which is the eigenvalue under dilatation. So that's the thing that we're going to have to discuss. And now we're going to write a transformation that essentially gives a representation of the conformal symmetry on the operators. Okay. But maybe before that, let me say very briefly something related to the homework or whatever that name is called that you had. So in any quantum field theory, relativistic quantum field theory, there exists a canonical operator by virtue of the fact that any quantum field theory is invariant under translation. Okay. Which is the energy momentum tensor. Okay. This is a consequence. The existence of the energy momentum tensor is a consequence of translational invariance. Okay? And translational invariance, via another term, tells you that the energy momentum tensor is conserved. Okay? That's just an abstract statement. It's conserved on shell. Okay? So it means that once you use the equations of motion, the divergence of the energy momentum tensor vanishes. Then we know that if you have Lorentz symmetry, then the energy momentum tensor is symmetric. Or can be, more precisely, it can be made symmetric. Okay? And the reason I'm talking about the energy momentum tensor is that the energy momentum tensor is the object that knows about space-time transformations, right? I mean, it's the one that talks to the metric, right? It's conjugate to the metric. The precise term, what is the energy momentum tensor? It's essentially, I'm not being careful with factors of two and stuff like that, but maybe the first time I will. You know that you can think of the energy momentum tensor as the response to your theory, to coupling the theory to an almost flat space. You take your theory in flat space, you couple it to Kerr space, and then you ask what happens when I do a small perturbation away from flat space. This defines the energy momentum tensor. So the energy momentum tensor is the operator in the theory that knows about the space-time transformations. Okay. So we are now in a conformal field theory, and we have the Poincaré transformations. So this is what the Poincaré transformations tells us about the energy momentum tensor. It tells us that it's conserved and symmetric. So now you can ask what other constraints does the energy momentum tensor have to obey in a conformal field theory? Because now we have more symmetries, right? We have a dilatation and we have a special conformal transformation. Okay. So now this may be an exercise, but let me just tell you briefly what the answer is. So let's just follow our notes. So this is the definition of the energy momentum tensor. Now, a conformal transformation is a diffeomorphism that obeys the conformal Killing vector equation. So under a general diffeomorphism, can someone tell me what this thing is? So now imagine I do a small diffeomorphism of this type. What is the infinitesimal variation of the metric under a small diffeomorphism?
The derivative.
Okay, so more concretely, it would be like d mu zeta nu plus d nu zeta mu, right? Okay, but now we're not doing an arbitrary diffeomorphism. We're doing a diffeomorphism that's a solution of the conformal Killing vector equation. So what can I do with this? Can I replace it with something else? That's what we discussed last lecture. What does this equal to for a conformal Killing vector? The right-hand side was, some coefficient 2 over d, right? The divergence of the conformal Killing vector times eta mu, right? That is the conformal Killing equation, right? So now I can just plug this thing here. And what I have is that the trace of the energy momentum tensor, t mu nu eta mu nu, is the trace of the energy momentum tensor. So I'm not caring about factors of two irrelevant factors. So I have that t mu nu eta mu nu, which usually we write as t mu mu. So this is the trace of energy momentum tensor times the gradient of zeta, OK? Now, what is a symmetry? A classical symmetry, at least. You have to worry about anomalies, and we will worry about anomalies in one of the lectures. So if a given transformation is a symmetry, the action should be invariant under that transformation, right? So for this to be a symmetry, this has to be zero. And now I have to look at the divergence of the conformal Killing vector. But here I wrote the conformal Killing vector, right? So you know how to take the divergence. And now, what I want you to convince yourself, I'm saying something trivial, it's not sad, just making a statement. So implies that so I already told you what translational invariance implies for the energy momentum tensor. I told you what Lorentz symmetry implies for the energy momentum tensor. Now I tell you what invariant under dilatations tells you about the energy momentum tensor. It tells you that the trace of the energy momentum tensor is a total derivative. And so that's something you're going to try to show, that you have all the ingredients in the blackboard to do it, and it's a one-line proof, essentially. And the more subtle special conformal transformation tells you that the trace of the energy momentum tensor is even of a more specific form. It's a double derivative. It's a second derivative of some operator, L mu nu. OK? So if you wish, you can say that the conformal field theory is a theory. How would you know that you have a conformal field theory? You could diagnose that you have a conformal field theory by looking at the trace of the energy momentum tensor, and if it takes this form, then it's a conformal field theory. If it doesn't, it isn't. Okay. And actually, another thing that you can try to prove that's a bit more technical, and you may do that in one of the exercises, you can prove that. So something that you may have seen in your courses is that the current associated to a symmetry is not unique. You can always shift the current by a term that doesn't change the charge, but it's automatically conserved. So let me just quickly. So J mu, I can shift J mu. So imagine J mu is a conserved current. I can construct an auxiliary current that has the same charge. Remember, the charge is the integral of the current over space. I can add to it a particular total derivative, OK? Some operator, arbitrary operator O, mu nu, where this guy is antisymmetric, okay? Now, if j mu is conserved, j mu tilde is conserved, right? Because this is conserved, and this guy is symmetric, and this is antisymmetric, okay? So that means that the form of a current associated to a symmetry is not unique. It can be improved. That adding this funny thing is called an improvement. So what you can prove quite easily is that if you have a conformal field theory, from abstract argument, it tells you that it has to be the trace of the energy momentum tensor is a second derivative of some operator. What you can prove, and you may do it in an exercise, is that you can add an improvement transformation, so something that will not change the charges, such that the new energy momentum tensor T mu mu is zero. So, and this looks nicer than this, so that's why I'm saying it. So one way you can diagnose the theory is a conformal field theory, is if there exists an energy momentum tensor which is traceless, essentially. So this is in one-to-one correspondence with the CFT.
Yes. Just a question. It seems like if we don't have, for example, which is, like, if we have, for example, a TMU symmetry that is verified, then we also have the dilatation.
Yes, but no, in principle, yeah, so you could have in principle. So K mu implies D, but not the other way around.
Okay, yeah.
So but there are powerful theorems, not proved in all generality and all dimensions, that in a theory that's reasonable, which means that it is unitary and blah 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 blah, that there's a theorem that tells you that. So this is definitely this way, and actually that just follows from the algebra of commutators. Because if you take P, the commutator of P mu with K nu, what do you get on the right-hand side? You get D. So if P and K are a symmetry, D is a symmetry. But the other way around, a priori, is not obvious. And I would say, no, it doesn't imply it. But one thing that's interesting is that there are theorems, non-trivial theorems, that tell you that if a theory that's unitary, I mean, that satisfies, like, you know, good conditions, that the theory that's dilatation invariant is automatically special conformal invariant. That's not an obvious statement, it's a non-trivial statement, but it's true. Well, this direction is obvious, this direction is not obvious. So for a conformal field theory, it will suffice to say that the trace of the energy momentum tensor vanishes.
Because that position is given by the second.
Yes, by the second one, yes. Yes, yes. So for example, I think in the exercise you had something that was obviously conformal, and when you computed the trace of the energy momentum tensor, it was not zero. But it was precisely of this form, so you could have added something to make it traceless. So now that I told you this, imagine now I take that theory and I add a mass term. Would the trace of the energy momentum tensor be non-zero if I had added a mass term to the scalar field? You're saying yes?
Yes.
No, but a mass term would break conformal symmetry, right?
It's not zero.
It's not zero. So what would you put on the right-hand side? More concretely, I mean, you should, okay, so I'll tell you the answer. So what you have to write down is exactly the operator that broke the symmetry. So you would add the mass term. You would add 1/2 of m squared phi squared. So the right-hand side of the trace of the energy momentum tensor, if you wish, is exactly the operator that break conformal symmetry, explicitly or via quantum effect. So in a quantum theory, so in a theory that's classically conformal invariant like Young-Mills, classically this is zero, but quantum mechanically there is a violation due to the running of the coupling. And here you would write down the beta function of the coupling, essentially. Beta the function of the coupling times f squared. Okay, so this was an example of how conformal symmetry tells us something immediately about the structure of the energy momentum tensor in the theory. But now we're going to go more in more detail about, more generally, what does conformal symmetry tell us about operators, all the operators in a conformal field theory. Okay, so now, so any CFT has these operators, but it may have others. So now let's discuss them. I mean, of course, an interesting CFT have many other operators. So operators in a CFT. But I mean operators, I mean local operators. Operators that are inserted at a point in space-time. You may know or not know that in a quantum field theory, there are operators that are supported not only on a point in space-time, they can be supported on curves and surfaces and so on. Yes, you have a question? Okay. So just like in a Poincaré invariant theory, all operators are in a representation of the Poincaré algebra. Here, all operators are in a representation of conformal algebra. Now, you know, from so the first thing that we have to do is we have to assign quantum numbers. So what is a representation? Essentially, a representation is characterized by certain quantum numbers that tells you how the thing transforms, right? So you're familiar with quantum mechanics, that the way we label operators is by looking at the maximally commuting set of operators that so we can use the eigenvalues of those operators as to label the quantum states, okay? Good. So for example, in a Poincaré invariant theory, it suffices to look at the quantum numbers under Lorentz transformations, right? I mean, so that tells us the spin. More generally, the representation under the Lorentz group. But in a conformal field theory, so we're going to look at the quantum numbers under M mu. So it's going to be the spin quantum number. But now we have other operators that can commute with M mu. So can someone tell me an operator that commutes with M mu?
D.
So we call it the spin quantum. I could call it S, but this is, you know, the spin quantum number depends on the dimension D. So I'm writing S schematically. But you know, it would be like a scalar, a vector, a spinor, a tensor, whatever. But we also have, so since now we have more symmetry, we have to give more information. We have to label the operators with the eigenvalue of the operator that is that commutes with this guy, okay, which is the dilatation operator. And that gives us the scaling dimension. Delta, that we discussed many, many times, okay? So operators in a conformal field theory are labeled by the spin and the scaling dimension. In a usual quantum field theory, you would only have the spin because D is not a symmetry. Okay? But now that this is a symmetry, we have to specify how it transforms. Okay. Another thing that's remarkable about the CFT that it's very important is that there are two classes of operators in CFT. And I'll try to make an analogy with SU to spin. We have what we call primary operators and descendants. So primary operators are operators that transform a simple, yes. Well, that followed from the conformal algebra that I derived in the last lecture. The commutator of D with M mu vanished.
Physical reason for why this should be so? Because like M mu is kind of part of the Poincaré algebra and D is a dilatation operator, so they should commute.
It should commute, why? Because D is a scalar. D has no Lorentz indices, right? So a scalar commutes with Lorentz transformations. That's why it commutes. And that's the only scalar in the conformal algebra.
That's the only thing that commutes?
Yes, because what else do we have? I mean, we have a finite list. We have P mu. P mu doesn't commute with M mu, right? And K mu has an index, so it cannot commute with M mu. So we're left with D. Okay. So primary operators are the ones that transform as tensors. Under a conformal transformation. That means that they transform, another way of saying it, they transform in a linear representation. Okay? So you're familiar about the transformation of tensors in general relativity under a diffeomorphism? Primary operators are the ones that transform precisely like a tensor in general relativity, except that in this context, the diffeomorphism that we take is not the most general diffeomorphism, it's the diffeomorphism that is a solution of the conformal Killing vector equation. And then there are operators that are descendants that do not transform as tensors. They transform in a more complicated way. But the point is that the transformation properties of descendant operators are completely fixed in terms of a primary operator. Okay, so any operator belongs in a family, okay? Where upstairs in the chain, there's a primary operator, and the operator might either be a primary, so it's at the top of the chain, or it can be a descendant, which is in the lower chain. So let me make an analogy with SU2 angular momentum. Okay, so you have a representation of a spin J. The states are labeled by J, and then you have M, right? Or whatever this thing is called, azimuth, I don't know what the... And M can go from minus J to J, right? So what you do is you start with the primary operator, which is JJ, where the third component of the angular momentum is maximal. And then you construct all other states by acting with, J minus, that decreases the J3 eigenvalue, right? So then you go down, you go down. Now, in SU2 angular momentum, this representation stops because there's a finite number of states. There are two J plus one states, right? So if you're using the analogy with here, you would say that this guy is the primary operator. And then you can construct all the other ones by acting with the lowering operator. Okay? So now we have to understand what is the, so, and you go down by acting with J minus, right? So remember that in SU2 you have J plus, raising, lowering, and J3. And you go down the representation by acting with J minus, okay? So now we have to understand who is, what is the analog of J minus.
In the SU2 angular momentum, when you go down, you still have, they still transform vectorially, like linearly, right?
Yes, yes, so here is, yes, so this is just an analogy, so yeah. I mean, this still transform, you know, what I mean is it transform, the thing that is special about the primary operators is that when you look at the transformation, you only get, if you wish, the JJ component of the operator back, while for the descendants, imagine you're in the, say, JM component, if you do a transformation, it will talk to the JJ component. So a conformal transformation acting on a descendant may give you back the associated primary, okay? Okay, so now let's try to understand a bit better how we build the representation. The thing that will be important is that in a conformal field theory, if you understand everything about the primary operators, in a sense you have understood everything, because the descendant operators, all the properties of them are implied by the properties of the primaries, okay? So our goal will be to understand how to constrain correlation functions and transformation properties of the primary operators. So here I told you that in a conformal field theory, we have to specify the dimension of the operator, the eigenvalue of the operator under the dilatation operator. So let's look at an operator and let's diagonalize it. That's what it means that the operator has dimension D. The commutator of the dilatation operator with O has eigenvalue D. Now let's look at the following action of the following composite operator, or action of the following operator. So let me take O and look at the commutator O with P mu. Okay. Now you can use whatever this thing is called, the Jacobi identity, to compute what actually what we're trying to understand is what is the eigenvalue of this operator under the dilatation operator. But this is completely fixed by the conformal algebra, because once you know how, all that you need to know is how D commutes with P and O, right? So if you do that, what you get is that this is delta plus one P mu O. So you see that P mu is a raising operator. It increases the eigenvalue under the dilatation operator by one. While if I do now the same thing with K mu, since K mu is a lowering operator, we see that K mu is a lowering operator. Okay. So now we can go back to this discussion. Yes.
The first line is something you assume, or
the first line is a fiat. I'm saying that in a conformal field theory, all operators should have a well-defined scaling dimension, because I'm diagonalizing the maximal set of commuting operators that includes. That was Lorentz and scaling dimension. So yeah, so this is by virtue of the fact that we're in a CFT and D is a symmetry. So now we can say, so you see that the eigenvalue under dilatation is decreased by k mu and increased by p, okay? So what is a primary operator in this language? The primary operator is an operator that is annihilated by k mu, okay? So if you wish, is literally the analog. So this is one-to-one correspondence with the statement that the highest weight state in an SU2 is exactly the state or the operator, what I'm not setting the language of states, that, oops, that tells you that J plus plus J equals zero. Okay. That's the high, in another language, this is called the highest weight vector. Vector. Okay. So now we can build a representation. So if I have a primary O, so O is a primary. How are we going to build the entire representation? So this primary will have some spin S label and some eigenvalue under dilatation delta. Now, how do we construct the rest of the descendants? So these are the states that you create out of the highest weight vector. So I'm going to write it like this. So the way you do it is you act with p mu, arbitrary number of times. So once, so I'm not going to put commutators, just there's p mu acting on O, p mu acting on O, and so on, an arbitrary number of times. This is to be contrasted with, in SU2, you would have the JJ component, and now you act with J minus, and you would get the JJ minus one component, the JJ minus two component, blah, blah, blah. Now, the one important difference with this is that you can act with an arbitrary number of P mu's, okay? While in SU2, there are a finite number of states. And that's just a statement that the conformal algebra is a non-compact symmetry, and the number of states in the representation is infinite dimensional. You're already familiar with that from, if you wish, from the Lorentz. From Poincaré. Okay, so and what is the dimension of the various states? It's, this guy will have dimension delta, this will have delta plus one, delta plus two, and so on. Okay? And all these guys, so this is a primary, and all these guys, this infinite sequence is a descendant. Now, I said that the properties of the descendants are completely fixed in terms of the properties of the primaries. And that should be obvious now, because in plain language, what is this operator? Can someone tell me what this operator is? The commutator of P mu with O? Like this is just in usual quantum mechanics. How is P mu represented in quantum mechanics? It's a derivative, right? So this guy is just exactly the same as just the derivative of this operator. So essentially, all the descendants are just trivial derivatives, arbitrary number of derivatives acting on the primary. Okay. So obviously, if you know how O transforms under a spacetime transformation, you know how all derivatives of O transform under a spatial transformation conceptually. Just take derivatives, right? Good. So therefore, since we know, so once we fix the transformation of the primary, then all of this is just, it may be complicated, but is has all the information about the transformations is fixed by, in terms of the primary one. You just have to take derivatives of the transformation. Okay. So therefore, in a conformal field theory, all that we really need to know to conceptually solve the problem is to understand the properties of the primary operators. The descendants just come along for the ride. They bring no new, everything about them is fixed by kinematics. There is no dynamics anymore because the dynamics is in the correlation functions of the primaries, the descendants. You take the correlation of the primaries and you start taking derivatives and then you know it. So it has no new information beyond, yes?
Well, is it here that the primary exists, so that there's an operator if x came to zero?
Sorry?
Is it true that there's always an operator if you act
Yes, I mean, that would be the statement that the CFT has, otherwise the CFT would have no operators.
Okay.
Yeah, so in fact, and it can be shown that, so I mean, this is something that you can understand from what I said so far, but that in a CFT, in two dimensions, it turns out that a CFT can have a finite number of primary operators, so just a finite list. But for example, if you go to above two space-time dimensions, necessarily a CFT has an infinite number of primary operators. So there's an infinite number of those fellows. And one of the things that you have to do is to characterize them in a CFT. So what is what you need to understand many things. You need to understand what are these operators, their spin quantum numbers, or their dimensions. And then their correlation functions. That's yet another layer of complication. Yeah. OK. Good. So now now that we understood that there is this special notion of a primary operator and that this guy forms a representation of the conformal algebra, now what we want to discuss is how the primary operators transform under conformal transformations.
By acting on the base, you mean taking commutators, right?
Yes, okay. Yes. Just like in SU2, you would take the commutator of J plus with whatever operator that had non-trivial spin, SU2 spin. Or in the Lorentz group, you look at the commutator of the Lorentz generator with this ideal energy momentum tensor. OK. So now we're going to look at the transformations. Of primary operators. Under a conformal transformation, OK? So what are we going to do? We're going to take x mu and make a conformal transformation to x tilde mu. And it will be convenient for notation to think of, so a conformal transformation, as I said, form a group, right? So one way you can think of the group, you pick a group element, you make a conformal transformation from x to x tilde. I can represent this as the group element g acting on the point x, OK? So g is just some group element, it's a conformal. And remember that what was a conformal transformation was, I'm not going to write all the glory indices, was a transformation of this type that obeyed this equation. Right? So now what we want to do is essentially, and the thing that we proved in the previous lecture is that when you look at the infinitesimal form of the transformations, you get a set of conformal Killing vectors. And those conformal Killing vectors represent the conformal algebra through their commutators. The commutator of two conformal Killing vectors gives you a different conformal Killing vector. Okay? So now what I want to do is represent the conformal symmetry on the operators. Okay? So we need to know how an operator O of x that has dimension spin s and dimension delta transforms under such a transformation, OK? So you're familiar from just usual quantum field theory that if I give you an operator that has spin and you make a Lorentz transformation, that operator transforms. And there are two aspects to the transformation of an operator, because these are space-time transformations, OK? They act also on the location of the point. So a transformation acts both on the internal quantum numbers, like spin, OK? But also acts on the space-time point. So we have to determine what I call the spin part of the transformation that acts on the internal quantum numbers. So this will be the internal quantum numbers, will be the Lorentz spin and the scaling dimension. But then there will be like a kinematical part or orbital part that acts just on how the operator shifts, which is the most trivial part, if you wish, of the transformation. Okay. Now, let's look at the transformed operator. Now, if this was a Lorentz, I mean, in particular, conformal transformations include Poincaré transformations, right? So let me write an index here. So now I'm going to use a slightly different notation. So I'm going to use, let me write A. So this A is an index for Lorentz spin. Okay? I said that an operator is labeled by Lorentz spin, quantum number, and dilatation. Okay? So this index could be a trivial index, which means that it would be a scalar, it could be a vector, it could be a spinor index, it could be blah, blah, blah. Okay? So now I want to know how this operator transformed under a conformal transformation. Now, if this was just a Lorentz transformation, you would know what to do. There would be part of the transformation would act on this index, right? It would tell you what the spin of this guy is, and then there's going to be a part that will act on the position of the space-time. Okay. So now what I'm going to say, let me write something that should be intuitive. Okay. Okay, I remember this Rx is this matrix that I introduced in the previous lecture that was an orthogonal, a local orthogonal transformation. Remember that this was the matrix that depended on X that obeys this equation. Okay? Now, if this was just a, if you were in a Lorentz invariant theory, the usual Lorentz invariant theory, this is how you have seen operators transform. You rotate the spin quantum numbers. So act on spin quantum numbers and on orbital, on the position of the operator, okay? So this would be just an orthogonal rotation and a Lorentz rotation acting on the spinor indices and then just a translation, okay? Now, in a conformal field theory, remember that I said that a conformal transformation is something that's locally, a local Lorentz rotation, but that depends on space-time point, times a dilatation. So this is very intuitive. All that I've done is I've told you how an operator transforms under a Lorentz transformation. Okay, it acts on the spin and it shifts the point. Okay, but now the Lorentz transformation is space-time dependent. Okay, good. So that takes care of the transformation properties of the operator under the spin quantum number. I haven't told you there is no delta anywhere on the right-hand side, right? So now I have to tell you. How do I know? What is the information about the scaling dimension in the transformation? Okay. And now the way it is encoded is like in general relativity when you have a density like this, you know, the square root of the determinant of the metric under the diffeomorphism doesn't transform as a tensor; it transforms as a density. There is a Jacobian factor in front of it. So delta is exactly of this type. So. The information about delta is that in the transformation, you have the determinant of the Jacobian of the transformation to the power delta divided by the space-time dimension d. Okay? So if you wish, I mean, a primary operator is just a tensor. But it's a tensor that transforms under Lorentz, as you already know, and it's a density. With a weight delta, which is the scaling dimension. Okay. So as you see, it's a linear transformation, right? It maps O to O. Okay. It doesn't mix with any other funny things that it will happen for the descendant.
When is on the left hand this orbital evaluated at x or at x two?
At x. Yeah, that's an important thing to get straight. This can lead.
But then what is on the right hand side? Shouldn't x be downstairs and upstairs we have g inverse x?
No. You mean here, the Jacobian?
Yeah.
No, the Jacobian is like that. Now, there is an interesting question that you need to ask is, what's happening here? Here, I'm acting on the spin quantum numbers by a g, like a rotation by g, but I'm acting on the space-time coordinates at g inverse. Why is that?
Because we're trying to understand the new field in terms of the field at the old point and acting on that.
I mean, you can say those words, but what would go wrong if here I had put gx instead of g inverse x? Well, what do we require of this transformation? That it's a representation of the conformal algebra. So it means that if I make two consecutive transformations, so imagine I make a transformation under the group element G1 times G2, right? And there are two ways of thinking about it. I do the transformation by G1 times G2, or I can think of G1 times G2 as G1 times G2, okay? So do the transformation in one shot, just G1 times G1, G2, or first do G1 and then G2. You should get the same thing. That's what it means, that the representation. And you can write down and convince yourself that unless on the orbital part I act with G inverse, the things wouldn't weld properly. So this is required, so that this is a representation. So actually, this is also true for Lorentz, by the way. Okay. And can someone tell me what equation should LAB obey? I mean, it should be a representation. So it should be that L, I'm not going to write all the indices, L, G1. So L is a matrix, right? So it's a N by N matrix, where N is the dimension of the representation under the Lorentz group, right? So for a vector, it would be a d-dimensional representation. And it has to be, the fact that the L is a representation is just a statement that LG1 times LG2 is LG1, G2, okay? So L has to be a representation of the Lorentz group. So, you know, this guy, you know, for a vector is given in terms of, you can write in terms of Kronecker deltas, for a spinner in terms of the Clifford algebra of gamma matrices, and for tensors likewise. And the thing that, the other thing that you have to be careful is that if you want this to be true, so that it's an honest, I mean, we're trying to find a representation of the Lorentz, of the conformal algebra on our operators, right? So this has to be true. Then you need the action on the space-time coordinates to be the opposite one. I will not, you can try to convince yourself of that. So that's it. So this is the finite form of a transformation, of a conformal transformation on a primary operator. It's just a tensor. And it's as close as possible to what you already know about Lorentz. It transforms as a Lorentz tensor with a space-time dependent Lorentz transformation, and it acts by a dilatation that's controlled by this weight. And this fits with what we discovered geometrically, that a conformal transformation is locally, it's locally a Lorentz rotation and a dilatation. A dilatation by this weight, precisely, by this scaling factor, okay? Okay, so now let's unpack this a little bit. So let's look how, under a dilatation, how this looks like. So x mu goes into x mu, x mu goes into lambda x mu, okay? And for simplicity, let's look at a scalar operator. So I said this, and for a scalar operator, this matrix is just one, right? L is just the identity matrix, okay? So then under a scaling operator, a scaling transformation, that's how a primary operator transforms. It transforms homogeneously. So X is mapped to lambda inverse X, and then it transforms with a weight, homogeneous weight that is determined by the scaling dimension. And if you remember your statistical mechanics, these are the kind of operators that are important when you are near a critical point. When you're near a critical point, things should scale homogeneously with the positions. Okay. And that's why primary operators are crucial in studying critical phenomena, because these are the ones that have exactly those properties. Okay, so here I told you in words why this is the way that it should have transformed. This is, this furnishes a representation of the conformal algebra on O. Another way we can also establish this is by looking at infinitesimal transformations. So now let's look at what happens under infinitesimal. Okay? So we're gonna do x mu equals x mu plus zeta mu. And now let's look at an infinitesimal form of the transformation. So I'm going to write delta OA delta. What is this? By definition, is at x is OA delta tilde at x minus OA delta at x. So what do? I go here, and I just keep the linear terms in zeta here, right? That's what I'm doing. That's what an infinitesimal transformation is. And then I just subtract to get the infinitesimal form. And then you get things that will look familiar. that will emphasize the fact that a conformal transformation is a local rotation and a local dilatation. So there is the orbital part, which is just that you translate the operator. This is like the Lie derivative term. So this is the orbital part. And now let's look at the spin part. So there's going to be a part that depends, which is a Lorentz transformation, a local Lorentz transformation. Now, this, what is this M mu nu R? This is a representation of the Lorentz algebra. So for example, if this was a spinner, this would be like the commutator of the gamma matrices. So this is how an infinitesimal transformation, conformal transformation acts as a Lorentz rotation with a very specific local Lorentz factor, which is where omega mu nu of x is omega mu nu, the Lorentz transformation parameter, plus a piece that comes from the special conformal transformation, which is minus 2x mu b nu minus x nu b mu. So if we were just doing a pure Lorentz transformation, this guy wouldn't be there, right? You would just have the Lorentz transformation. But as I said, a special conformal transformation can be, if you wish, decomposed into a Lorentz transformation and a dilatation. Okay? So now I've told you how the operator transforms under the Lorentz part, and under the dilatation part, it will transform with weight delta, with parameter w of x, or a delta. Okay, and this is precisely how O transforms as a local under a dilatation, where this wx is a local dilatation, so it's lambda, the thing that you would get if you did a pure dilatation, plus a space-time dependent term that comes from the special conformal transformation. Okay. So that's it. So that's how, and again, we split things into, okay, and this is the representation of the dilatation operator. So the spin quantum number appears here, R, and the dilatation quantum number appears here in delta. Okay. Now, how can we check that this is a representation? Can someone tell me how you would check whether this is a representation of the conformal algebra? What did we say about in the previous lecture about what happens to conformal Killing vectors when you look at their commutator? You get a new conformal Killing vector, right? So here, what we can do is check whether the following is true. So we prove that if delta 1 and delta 2 are conformal Killing vectors, so have delta zeta 1, delta, this is just a kinematic, just conformal Killing vectors. We prove that this guy is also a conformal Killing vector. Okay. So how would you know that you have a representation of the conformal algebra? What you would do is you would look at delta zeta 1, delta zeta 2, acting on the operator O A delta, has to give you delta zeta 3, acting on O A delta. That is the statement that the infinitesimal conformal transformations are represented on the operator, okay? And you can check as an exercise that this precisely has that property. Good. Now, one thing that you can check is that imagine now instead of looking at the primary here, I look at the descendant. So this guy was d mu, this was d mu of O. That would be the first descendant in the family, right? Now clearly, so notice that here, all that appears here is always O, right? Oh, I forgot the delta here, but okay. If I look at the derivative here, P mu, what's gonna happen? I will have to act with the derivative here. And in particular, what am I gonna get here? There is a term that will act, the derivative will act on omega, right? So there's a term that will act on O, and you're gonna get the descendant on the right-hand side, but there is a term that where the derivative is gonna act on omega x, and it's going to give you a non-zero piece, but now the operator that appears here is O, not derivative of O. So that's why it doesn't transform as a tensor. If you wish, you have a descendant. A conformal transformation maps a descendant to a primary, okay? While a primary stays within itself under a conformal transformation. Okay. Good. So now that we know how conformal transformation acts on primaries, what we want to do now is to want to constrain the position dependence of correlators of primaries. And that's where we'll find a remarkable thing, the first remarkable result. So essentially what I want to know is that imagine I give you a collection of operators, O1 at point X1, O2 at point X2, blah, 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 O3 at point X3. And I want to compute, say, this, O1, X1, ON, XN. You're familiar with, okay, so now you can ask, just based on symmetries alone, what can I say about the functional dependence of this correlation function, okay? So if you were in a Lorentz invariant, in a Poincaré invariant theory, what would the answer be? What can you say about the form of such a correlation function in a Poincaré invariant theory? Sorry? Okay, yes. No, but I'm saying yes. No, but more concretely, what is the possible dependence on the function on the d vectors x1, x2, x3, x4?
It can only depend on the difference.
It can only depend on the difference because a transitional invariant tells you that things only depend on the distance between points, and rotational invariant it only depends on the magnitude. Actually, it's not only it depends on the that's Lorentz invariant. But you know, this is an arbitrary function, right? It will be an arbitrary function, if you wish, of xi minus xj, right? This is a huge mess. You don't know anything about this, and only dynamics will tell you. So the thing that we will argue now, and all the details are in the note, you can go through them carefully, is that in a conformal field theory, the position dependence of the 2 and 3 point functions is completely fixed. So it means that for the 2 and 3 point functions, even in a Poincaré invariant theory, we would still have arbitrary functions floating around here, right? It would be a function of the distances between the points. In a conformal field theory, this function is just fixed, just a fixed function that I'm going to write down. Of course, the coefficient is not fixed, and the coefficient has to be determined by dynamics, okay? Another thing that we will see in the next lecture is that the higher prime functions are not completely fixed. The position dependence is not completely fixed, but the higher prime functions are completely determined from the expressions of the 2 and 3 point functions and conformal symmetry. Yes.
So when you say position is
space time. Space time. Yeah. This is a function of. I mean, this has to be a function on the right hand side of x1, x2, x3, right? So I'm saying that the position dependence is a fixed function of x. You will never find a conformal field theory that has a different x dependence. While there are many Poincaré invariant theories that would have many different types of f of x. Well, no, what's confusing you? Because then maybe I'm not saying something very clear.
It
will depend. Okay, so the functional form of the dependence. So there will be. I'm going to write it down in a second. So there's a position dependence and which is fixed in terms of the delta, in terms of the dimension. So the functional form is completely fixed. The actual function depends on delta 1, delta 2, delta 3. But the functional form is completely fixed. Okay. So this is, you should be shocked by this, because that's definitely not what you're used to. So now let me tell you how I'm not, again, in the notes, there's a very kind of canonical derivation of this using word identities. Here I'm going to give you an intuition of why this is true. So why is this true? Just intuitively. So let's look at the three-point functions. So I'm going to have 3 points, x1, x2, and x3. These are 3D-dimensional vectors, right? We're in this space and dimensions. So now what I'm going to prove for you now is that by doing conformal transformations, which are symmetries, by definition of a conformal are symmetries, I can map arbitrary 3 points in space-time to 3 fiducial points, 0, a vector that has a 1 in the first component and 0 in all the other ones, and infinity. And therefore, since I can map any 3 points to a fiducial point, all position dependence is completely determined. Okay? Because, yeah. That's definitely not true in a Poincaré invariant theory. You cannot map arbitrary 3 points to these points. And you will see why in a second. Okay? So let's prove this now very quickly. This is easy. And so let's start with 3 points. So what can I do? Let me first put one of the points at infinity. I already said at the beginning of the lecture that any point can be mapped to infinity by a special conformal transformation. Or if you wish, you can do first a translation and bring this point to the origin and then do an inversion that will map it to infinity. So by acting with k mu, I can map this to x1 double prime. This will be transformed in some kooky way that I don't know. And then infinity, right? I'm just using symmetries of the problem, okay? Now, I can use translations. Now, translations famously don't change infinity, so this stays there. But I can map this point, say, to the origin, right? I can map any point by a translation to the origin. And this guy will be some other point, x double prime. OK, now I can do something else. I'm going to try to bring it as close as possible to this form, OK? Now I can do a Lorentz rotation. A Lorentz rotation preserves the length, OK? But what I can do is I can try to, you know, if you have a vector, you can always do a rotation around that vector, OK? So now take a rotation along the 1j component. So this is a 1j generator. This will be a rotation around the 1j plane, OK? Where j goes from 2 to d minus 2d, right? By doing this rotation, I can bring the vector to align along the first axis, okay? So this would be like some a 0, 0, 0, infinity, okay? But now you would say, oh, I still have 1 degree of freedom left. I have a. But what can I do now? I can do a dilatation and bring this to precisely that. So you see that in a theory that has all these symmetries, all the position dependence is fixed in terms of what that at one point. Okay, so that clearly immediately says that the position dependence is completely determined by kinematics. This stops to be true when you have 4 points, but as I said, the number of variables that the 4-point function can depend on is very much reduced compared to Poincaré invariant theory. It can depend only on one complex parameter. And we will discuss this more in the next lecture. So now, how would you derive this from, and that's how I do it in the notes. How would you derive this from first principles? So symmetries, what they do is they constrain the form of correlation functions. So what we have to say is a symmetry relates a set of correlation functions to a different set of correlation functions that are related by the symmetry. So to constrain the form of the correlators, take and for now I'm gonna do it for scalars for simplicity, but this can be done for any. So let's look at the scalar operators or scalars under the Lorentz group. So I will have O1, X1. So the statement about the symmetry is this, that if you look at the endpoint function of n transformed operators under a conformal symmetry, evaluated at the point x, x1, xn, this has to be the same as the correlation function of the untransformed operators at the same point. That is what a symmetry is. It relates the transformed operators at one point to the original points at the same points. Okay. But now you have to, if you wish, okay, so you have to, so now you could solve this problem in many ways. One would be to use this rule, right? You know how O tilde is written in terms of O. And that will give you, if you wish, you have to solve a functional equation on in the left hand side and right hand side. If you want to do it infinitesimally, you can do it infinitesimal form. Remember that we defined this delta O, right? So now let me make an infinitesimal transformation. The left hand side will transform in this way, right? And if you wish, we can write this as the sum from 1 to n of O1 x1 OL delta OL xl ON xn equals 0. That's also very intuitive. That tells you that if I have a correlation function, that correlation function should be invariant under the action of the symmetry. And what you do is you act on the action of the symmetry on the operator, it transforms infinitesimal as a delta O, and then you apply your Leibniz rule. You have delta O1 plus delta O2 plus delta O3, blah, blah, and this equals 0. And since we know explicitly the form of delta O, if you wish, this gives a set of differential equations for the correlator, okay, that you can solve. And that's what I do in the notes. But I think this argument here tells you that this had to be true for the 2 and 3 point function. So let me write down what the answer is for the 2 and 3 point function, and then I'll stop there. And you can derive what I'm going to write down just by exactly doing this. Okay. So maybe quickly, first, actually, before doing the 2 point function, imagine that we do the 1 point function of a scalar, OK? Can someone tell me what this has to be in a CFT? No, first of all, what can this be in a QFT without conformal symmetry?
It has to be independent.
Yeah, otherwise known as a constant. In a quantum field theory, this can be a constant, but not in a conformal field theory. What's the reason for that? If there was a constant here, and I now edit a scale transformation, the left-hand side would transform, right? It would be scaled homogeneously, but the constant doesn't, it's a constant, so.
Unless the scaling dimension is zero, right?
Yeah, so yes, unless, yeah. And in a unitary CFT, this is just the identity operator. So the one-point function is trivial for all operators except the identity operator. Now the two-point function, again, in a relativistic quantum field theory, it would be a function of x1 minus x2. In a conformal field theory, it's a fixed function of 2 delta 1, delta delta 1, delta delta 2. Okay? So again, you see that the functional form is completely fixed, that the dimension appears, but everything is fixed. And a three-point function, so here I fix the normalization of the two-point function. You can always rescale operators to fix the normalization. So the two-point function is one. Now the normalization of the three-point function is important. It's dynamical. And that of course, is not fixed by symmetry. So it will be a function of C1, 2, 3. This is it doesn't depend on space-time, but it's like a tensor that tells you how the three-point function, what the three-point function is. And that's not determined by symmetry. That's determined by dynamics. And in the next lecture, we will see how dynamics fixes this. Another position dependence is just x1, 2. So I'm going to define xij to be xi minus xj. Okay, so this is going to be x1, 2, delta 1 plus delta 2 minus delta 3, x2, 3, delta 2 plus delta 3 minus delta 1, x1, 3, delta 1 plus delta 3 minus delta 2. Okay. So here again, the position dependence is completely fixed in a conformal field theory, which would definitely not be the case in a quantum field theory. So to begin with, in a CFT, we have, if you wish, since all this is constrained, we can just focus on the data. What is the data of a CFT? We're going to use this language a lot, data of CFT. What is the collection of things I have to tell you about the CFT to completely determine the two and three point functions? I have to tell you the collection of dimensions of the primaries, delta I. So I have to tell you the scaling dimensions. And I have to tell you the coefficients of the three-point functions. Okay? This is precisely the data that appears here. The deltas appear here, right? And the Cijs appear here, okay? And in the next lecture, we're going to see that actually this data alone plus clever symmetry fixes all the endpoint functions, okay? So I'm running a bit over time, so I should stop here.